America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, the good news, Baruch Hashem, our phones are working. We will be taking your calls today. It's Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, happy Friday, happy weekend, whatever's your thing. You want to see a mind-bogglingly great piece of video, go over to sanders.senate.gov, Bernie Sanders' website, Senator Bernie Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov, and play that video right up at the top there about his taking on Jim Nussle. And, in fact, Senator Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, and Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Tell us about, and by the way, I should mention, you're in the midst of some wild and crazy stuff that has to do with the end of the session, and you may have to leave at the bottom of the hour.
That's right.
So, tell us about Jim Nussle.
With a little bit of luck, Congress will be adjourning for the August break in a little while, so there's a lot of stuff that's going on I'm going to have to pay attention to, but for a start, the president nominated the former congressman from Iowa, Jim Nussle, to be head of his OMB, and I voted against that and, in fact, have placed that nomination on hold, not so much because of Nussle, but because of this president. You know, Tom, you have a president and administration that tells the American people literally every single day how great the economy is doing. That's what they tell us. Meanwhile, you may have seen this, there was a Wall Street Journal poll yesterday which said that two-thirds of the American people think that we are in a depression now or we are heading to a depression. In other words, there is a huge disconnect between Bush's perception of what's going on in the economy and how the American people feel about it. And in this instance, of course, the American people are right. Poverty is increasing. The middle class is shrinking. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. People are losing their health insurance. People are losing their pensions. People are paying $3.10 for a gallon of gas. People can't afford to send their kids to college. And George Bush thinks the economy is booming. So I wanted to send him a little bit of a message by telling him that before he gets a new economic advisor, the head of the OMB, he might want to check in to the middle class of this country rather than just his millionaire friends to assess what's going on. So that's kind of what that's about.
Yeah, the OMB being the Office of Management and Budget, and Jim Nussle being a big supporter of doing away with the estate tax.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was on the floor the other day talking about the repeal of the estate tax as it currently stands. The only beneficiaries would be the top 2 or 3 tenths of 1%. Now, if you can believe this, one family, the Walton family that owns Walmart, that family would receive some $32 billion, that's a B, $32 billion in tax breaks if we repealed the inheritance tax. One family. Meanwhile, just yesterday, late last night, we passed an expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program to provide health insurance for 3 million more children. It cost us $35 billion for a five-year period, and Bush wants to veto it. So Bush thinks that it is more important to give $32 billion in tax breaks to one of the wealthiest families in America. We can afford to do that, but we can't afford to spend $35 billion over a five-year period to provide health insurance for 3 million children. And this is a guy who espouses family values. Give me a break.
Yeah, and in the meantime, our infrastructure is crumbling, our hospitals are falling apart, our schools are disintegrating, et cetera.
You got it. And if there's anything positive out of this terrible tragedy in Minnesota, and we don't know how many people eventually will be counted as dead, it is a reminder that not only our bridges and our roads and our dams and our wastewater systems and our water systems are at peril, but we need to radically rebuild our infrastructure to make it energy efficient, to begin the effort of reversing global warming. And it's going to be an expensive proposition. But rather than give tax breaks to people who don't need it, rather than spend $8 or $10 billion every month in Iraq, we can put Americans to work rebuilding our nation. And that seems to me a much higher priority.
Yeah, well said. You were, last week, when we talked with you, you were literally on a plane flying to Greenland.
Yes, I was.
Tell us about the trip.
Well, it was a short trip, unfortunately, only there for 2 days. But it was in one sense, breathtaking. We went out on a small boat and literally were bumping into not so small, icebergs, which, of course, made me think of the Titanic, but... It was just breathtakingly beautiful, but the point of the trip was it was not a trip to get to look at some beautiful scenery. It was to take a look, which we did, and see the receding of the Greenland's ice cap. And
their glaciers?
Yeah, their glaciers, which we were able to see. We were on a spot and could see very clearly where 10 years ago there had been ice, and now there's no ice. And that the ice sheet continues to recede and melt. And the immediate impact of that is the increase in water levels in the ocean, which could lead to flooding in countries like Bangladesh. But I think more importantly than just what we're seeing in Greenland is to understand that if we don't in the very near future get a handle on climate change, if we don't reverse global warming and cut back significantly on our greenhouse gas emissions, this entire planet is going to be in a lot of trouble in terms of flooding. I mean, you're just reading right now about the very weird temperature weather situations they're having in Europe, in the west coast of the United States. We've got to get a handle on it. And I am, as it turns out, fortunately, on the Environmental Committee, on the subcommittee that is going to be dealing with some major legislation. And we hope to make it as strong as we possibly can. As I've said many times, Tom, you know, some people say, well, gee, there's going to be economic dislocation if we break our dependency on fossil fuel, if we move to sustainable energy, and if we move to energy efficiency. And the answer is yes. But at the end of the day, I happen to believe we can create millions of good-paying jobs, making our country more energy efficient, rebuilding our rail system, moving us to solar, moving us to wind power, geothermal, and other sustainable forms of energy. There's just huge opportunities out there that if we are smart, we can go forward on and create a whole lot of good-paying jobs.
Yeah, and in fact, you and Senator Barbara Boxer, who's one of my heroes in the Senate, are co-sponsors of the Comprehensive Global
Right.
Warming Pollution Reduction Act.
Right. That is the strongest bill that has been introduced, and that would lower greenhouse gas emissions by 80% lower than the 1990 levels. And we do that through a cap and trade program. We do that by investing in energy efficiency and in sustainable energy.
Mm. Yeah, sounds like a great start. What else is happening in Congress this week?
Well, there's been some, you know, what you're seeing now in a general sense is efforts to reverse the disastrous 6 years that we had when Bush and the Republicans were the entire government. We had Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, and we had a one-party government. What we just saw last night did not go as far as I would like it to go in terms of providing health insurance to children. As you know, Tom, we are the only nation in the industrialized world that does not provide health care to all people through a national health care program. I want to see us move in that direction. But at least last night, we expanded health insurance to 3 out of the 9 million children who have no health insurance whatsoever. Bush is threatening to veto it. On the other hand, we got a number of Republicans to support it. I think we have a veto override, so we'll see what he does. We have passed recently a higher education bill, which would raise Pell Grants. That's the major source of financial aid to lower and middle-class families throughout this country from $4,300 to $5,100 and then up to $5,300. That will help many families deal with the very high cost of a college education. Just last week, the new minimum wage went into effect. It is, to my mind, after 10 years of inaction on the part of Republican leadership, we raised the minimum wage from $5.15 over a three-year period to $7.25. Doesn't go far enough, but it is a step forward. Right now, as we've just discussed, there's going to be a lot of effort to deal with global warming. Obviously, we have a president who will go down in history as the worst environmental president in the history of our country, not to mention all the other areas where he is the worst. And I think you're going to see some progress there as well. So we're making some progress. Clearly, we have a long way to go.
Yeah, indeed. And we just have a minute for our break here, Bernie. We're talking to Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.senate.gov is website. And just this amazing piece of video where you just go through this extraordinary recitation of things. I just want to commend people to that. We will be back taking your calls. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Program. Our number, 866-303-2270. You can drop into our live chat room over at airamerica.com or tomhartman.com. Also blogging at airamerica.com and the message board over at tomhartman.org. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders with us at least for the next few minutes. He's got a meeting. We're going to check it out at the bottom of the hour and see if he's got to head out. Quick thanks, very special thanks, by the way, to Justin Ewan, to Gerald Downer and Carmen Shanwell. Yesterday when our phones croaked and I was assuming that somebody pushed the button, a wrong button someplace. In fact, a piece of equipment had fried and they were just doing yeoman's work. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, shall we take some calls here?
Absolutely.
Okay. Fred in Madison, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Senator Bernie. I've got a question about the FISA Act. Now, we've known Bush has gone on television and, you know, bragged about breaking this law. From what I'm seeing in the papers, the Senate Intelligence Committee is looking to compromise with the Bush administration on changes to the act. But no one seems to know what these compromises are. Do you have any idea what's going on?
Well, Fred, that is exactly the meeting that I will be in about 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, this is exactly what is being discussed right now. I think the bottom line is that you have an administration that does not fully understand what the Constitution is about, has an idea that they can do anything at any time to anybody because they are the White House, and they are the administration. So the challenge that we face is understanding that terrorism is, in fact, a very serious issue. All of us are worried about another attack against the United States or other countries. That's a very, very real concern. So the challenge is, how do you effectively oppose terrorism and protect the American people without undermining the Constitution? And you have a president who basically says, hey, we're in a war against terrorism, we're a war in Iraq, I can do anything I want, anytime I want it, I don't have to go to a FISA court, I don't have to go to an independent judiciary, and I've got the Attorney General, Mr. Gonzalez, right here, that he'll make sure that everything is okay. Well, some of us, needless to say, have some concerns about that. So that is exactly what is being discussed as we speak right now.
Marty in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator Sanders and Tom. I'd like you to speak for a moment to the issue of the hedge fund managers and the reduced rate of taxation that Charles Schumer has been advocating, the 15% versus the 35%, which average people pay, yet they're supposed to be progressive. He's supposed to be progressive on this issue and is advocating a reduced rate for the wealthiest people in this country. It doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't seem
well,
like...
Marty, I agree with you. Some of these hedge fund executives have been making astronomical sums of money, and I think as Warren Buffett pointed out, he himself, I believe, pays a lower effective income tax rate than his secretary does. So what we need to do is not only rescind all of the tax breaks that Bush has given to his very wealthy millionaire and billionaire friends, but also come up with a tax system which is simple, which is fair, which is progressive, and which says that if you are making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know what? You're going to pay income tax on a progressive basis. And so I agree with Marty.
Richard in Kissimmee, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks for taking my phone call. Once again, about the bill and meeting, you're going 2.5 hours. Bush just came out and had a press conference and said that the Democrats are making the country weak again by not signing this bill. He wants you to stay over session, over Congress to give him the power to have this bill again. Are you guys going to cave in again and give him the power he wants?
Well, that whole issue is being debated literally as we speak right now. I think it is no secret that when you have a political party like the Republican Party, which is intellectually and bankrupt, programmatically bankrupt, which is opposing an expansion of children's health programs, which wants to give more tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country, which has nothing to say significantly about the health care crisis that we face, what Dick Cheney understands is their one card, their one ace in the hole, is to be saying that those of us who believe in constitutional rights are somehow soft on terrorism. Well, that's certainly not the case from my perspective, or what I believe, what I think most members of the Senate believe. We understand that terrorism is a very, very serious problem. But we're not going to see a president who suddenly, just before the recess, comes and says, the world is coming to an end, give me all kinds of power. No, that is not something that I am comfortable with, and that's what we're addressing today. Mm.
Yeah, good on you. Jason in Kankakee, Illinois. Only about 30 seconds here, Jason. A quick one.
Okay, Bernie, I'm a registered independent and an archaeologist. Has anybody made you aware of the real danger about the global warming, which would be the shift of the Japanese current and the Gulf Stream, which would bring upon us another ice age? It can happen in 3 years. Science has showed that's what happened with the last ice age.
Actually, we have heard some discussion about that, Jason. Yep.
Yeah, shutting down the Gulf Stream, it could be a real disaster. Senator Bernie Sanders, check out his website, sanders.senate.gov. There's just an amazing piece of video up at the top there you've got to take a look at. And, Bernie, you're gonna find out if you stick around with us, but odds are you can't. So,
right.
I'll
be back.
Say thank you.
Okay.
Okay. And Senator Bernie Sanders, 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio. 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Have to remember there'll be days like this.
Yes, indeed.
Yesterday
was one of those days. Today's a pretty good one. And once again, thanks to the folks to Justin and Carmen and Gerald, the folks in New York who, I mean, even I was thinking somebody screwed up, and no, it was the equipment screwed up. I was wrong. And they were right, and things are working now. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the program. Bernie is not back with us. Apparently, the meeting that he was talking about is continuing, and I think we all want him to be participating in that as much as anything else. I just want to play one short clip from his website where he's talking. He's talking to this guy who's been nominated by the Bush administration, Jim Nussel, to be the head of the Office of Management and Budget. And Bernie just lays out the economic reality that is facing Americans right now.
Senator Gregg and others, that the economy is really robust, is a word they use here in Washington. Let me ask you this. Since Bush has been president, over 5 million people have slipped into poverty. Nearly 7 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Median household income has gone down by nearly $1,300. 3 million manufacturing jobs have been lost. 3 million American workers have lost their pensions. Home foreclosures are now the highest on record. The personal savings rate is below zero, which hasn't happened since the Great Depression. The real earnings of college graduates have gone down by about 5% in the last few years. entry-level wages for male and female high school graduates have fallen by over 3%. Wages and salaries are now at their lowest share of GDP since 1929. Now, I will concede that President Bush has done a wonderful job for the wealthiest people in this country and for the CEOs of large corporations. If you receive this position, very important position, as head of OMB, are you prepared to go into the office and say, Mr. President, you've got to represent more than the wealthiest 1%, that the middle class is shrinking and poverty is increasing, and, Mr. President, we need policies to address the concerns of ordinary Americans?
Senator, as I said to the chairman, I'm not satisfied, even though there are statistics to show that there's growth.
Mr. Nussel. Wiggle, 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 weasel, weasel, weasel. But anyhow, Bernie Sanders taking him to task. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Eric in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was thinking about privatization of the military and how for the largest contractors and the weapons manufacturers, the economy probably is doing great. And I'd also like to bring up several instances in which war was justified. For instance, we all remember the Maine, or maybe some of us don't. Also, the Gulf of Tonkin, the Lusitania, and perhaps even 9/11, if you go to 9/11weknow.com. And I'm just concerned that Chertoff is going to make this economy a lot better for some of these private military corporations by, as Ron Paul put it, having another false flag operation and getting us into a war with someone else he'd like to.
Yeah, remember the Maine being the Spanish-American War, the Lusitania, World War One, the Gulf of Tonkin, obviously the Vietnam War. Yeah.
All of which were found to be caused by us, if you look deep enough.
Yeah, and it's something that we need to be talking about. Eric, thank you very much for raising the topic. It's well said. 1-866-303-2270, Dave in Queens, New York. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just want to first thank you for having Senator Sanders on. He's as a New Yorker, he's my favorite New Yorker senator, and a hero like Dr. Wellstone.
Yeah, even though he's representing Vermont now.
I know, but I want to claim him.
Yeah, everybody wants to claim Bernie. You know, he's also, you know, somebody called up and said, "Are you Democrats going to?" Bernie is not a Democrat. That's the other point.
I know he's an independent.
Yep.
And he actually went to the same high school as Coleman of Minnesota and Schumer of New York. And they all represent three different parties. It's never happened before.
That's interesting.
But the reason I called was yesterday I almost went through the TV set watching The Ghoul in Chief. He spends 1 minute talking about these people that died in Minnesota and then starts castigating in the Rose Garden the Democrats to pass his budget without increases, because this is what you have to do. I mean, this is what he does with people, dead people lying in the Mississippi because they won't spend a dime to maintain bridges and infrastructure. My 11-year-old son figured out with the steam pipe explosion in New York and the bridge going down in Mississippi, you know, we got a problem here. That's my 11-year-old, which means that we have a person in the White House who has less sense than an 11-year-old.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that logic, David, and it's well said. And in fact, let me take it even a step beyond this, and thank you for the call. There are people who are saying, in fact, I would say probably the majority of the Democratic senators and members of the House of Representatives are saying, let's roll back the Bush tax cuts. The top marginal rates in the United States, the top tax rate for income taxes, personal income taxes, and corporate income taxes didn't exactly follow the personal rate, but corporate taxes were also much higher too. The top tax rate from the 1940s until the early 1980s until the 60s was 91%, and from Kennedy's administration to Reagan's administration it was 70%. The top tax rate. And what that did is it acted as a cap on the amassment of mind-boggling amounts of wealth. And arguably, that was a very good thing. Not only that, it also produced revenue for the government, revenue that the government could use to build bridges, build tunnels, build roads, build hospitals, build schools. I mean, all of our build airports right across the board, all of our infrastructure. We were actually building infrastructure back in the day. And now we have a situation since the Reagan tax cuts. Reagan took that top 70% tax rate, which didn't even kick in until after you were making about $3.2 million. It was after that that you started paying that tax rate in today's dollars. Reagan took that down to 28%, and ever since then, in the last 26 years, America's infrastructure has been crumbling. Our schools are falling apart. Our, as you point out, the steam pipes in New York, the roads, the bridges, the train tracks. I mean, just right across the board, everything has fallen apart. Congressman Brian Barrett of Washington State was grilling David Walker, the comptroller of the Office of Management and Budget, the comptroller for the U.S., the guy who's in charge of, you know, keeping all the official statistics, about whether or not the Bush tax cuts helped the economy. Here's the dialogue.
Did the tax cuts that we've seen over the last number of years pay for themselves?
Absolutely not. Very few tax cuts pay for themselves.
Well, we can quote you on that as absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
So
they can quote you as saying absolutely not.
Absolutely, you can quote me as saying absolutely not.
So if we've seen a decline in the deficit, the decline in the deficit is not a direct result of the tax cuts.
As Dr. Orzag had said before, some tax cuts recapture part of the cost of some tax cuts, but the type that we've seen recently, they do not pay for themselves. And that's primarily due to economic growth, which is why we're seeing revenues go up. I think it's important for you to understand is if we have any inflation at all, if we have any economic growth at all, revenues are going to go up. If you do nothing, the question is, are they higher than otherwise they would have been had the action not been taken?
And if the answer to that question is?
I think he was asking you.
And the answer is?
You said the question is, are they
higher? Don't pay for themselves, so no, they're not higher than they otherwise would have been had the action not been taken.
Thank you.
Right. Congressman Brian Baird talking with Comptroller David Walker. So I'm suggesting that we shouldn't just be rolling back the Bush tax cuts back to the Clinton level of 33-34% or 35-36-37, whatever it was. We should be rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. Let's roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Max in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hey, Max.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom? Max.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey,
Max
Frederick here. Hey, you know, I'm about five blocks from that bridge here in Minneapolis that went down.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a chance, I would like to ask you a question. Get a hold of, or you talk to Bernie. For 17 years, they've known that bridge up here has been bad. And just a few months ago, they wouldn't sign a bill to fix these highways here in Minnesota because of a tax.
Right, it wasn't just that the Republican governor of Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty, wouldn't sign the bill. He actually vetoed several pieces of legislation, 20 full or partial vetoes, including a May 1st veto of a $334 million emergency capital investment bill and a $5 billion transportation bill 2 weeks later on May 14th.
Yeah. You know what I don't really understand, though, even as far back as 5 years ago, the state of Minnesota was warned about this bridge, and nobody did anything. They just as soon put a new pavement on the top of it. And 5 miles north of there, they've got a major million-dollar construction going on to widen the highway. That makes no sense to me when they got a bridge they know that's going down.
Right. And at the same time, we're building sports stadiums all over the country. If you want to take it up with somebody, you should talk to Phil Krenke. He is the president of the Taxpayers League of Minnesota and the guy who is congratulating Governor Tim Pawlenty. Or actually, I suppose you could take it up with Governor Pawlenty, the Republican governor of Minnesota, who vetoed these tax and spend measures that might have repaired all this. 866-303-2270, our phone number, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, talking to the Democrats. Dump them into those guys. By the way, I said that the video of Bernie taking on Jim Nussle was up at the top of his website. It's not. It's actually, and it's at the top of the website that I was looking at, which is on his webpage. If you go to sanders.senate.gov, which is Bernie's website, you will notice over on the right-hand side of that website a page that says audio video. And if you click on more, because the top three are not one of those, if you click on more, that takes you to his audio video page. And then if you go down the fifth or sixth link down, Sanders Quizzes Budget Nominee Office, you can watch that video of Bernie giving absolute hell to Jim Nussle. And, you know, and a fine thing, in my opinion, it is. Brian in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
I'm fine, but I'll get better. What's up?
I didn't catch all of Bernie's conversation with you, and I'm wondering if either he or you've spoken to other members of Congress about the Executive Order 13438.
This is the one that blocks the assets of people?
Right, yeah.
We talked with Bernie about it last week, and he said that he and several other members of Congress have been made aware of this and we're looking into it, and we, as you noticed, we didn't really have time to get into all that.
Right.
I'm guessing, you know, he said that the meeting that he has to go to has to do with whether or not they're going to push back on the FISA requests from the Bush administration and how hard, and I'm sure that there's a lot of debate going on within the Democratic caucus, which even though he's not a Democrat, he meets with the Democrats, he caucuses with the Democrats. And so I can't speak for Bernie. I don't know. I know that we've talked about it a lot on this program. There are many of us who are very, very concerned about this and frankly, who think that there should have been a legislative effort. I think it's going to be too late, given the recess now, to roll back or undo that executive order, because I believe that they become law after a certain period of time. As I recall, it was 30 days. And
yeah, I think it's the August 17th when it becomes law. Do you have any idea if it can be repealed by Congress?
Sure. Yes. Yes, I know that for sure.
Executive orders can be.
Executive orders can be undone by legislation, and in fact, they have been many times in the past.
Okay, that's part.
You know,
that's
entirely
good
possible.
To hear.
Okay.
Brian,
thanks a lot. Yep, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. Lauren Kirshner is with us from our staff on the Tom Hartman program, and also she's the producer of the Sam Cedar program over at Air America Radio, and she's in Chicago for the yearly COES convention. Hey, Lauren.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you with us. What's going on?
Oh, I'm having so much fun out here. It's been really, really great. Everyone is so friendly and so nice. I mean, I don't know what I expected. I guess, of course, they're going to be friendly and nice, but... You know, I guess
it could have been a conservative convention, you know.
with any, you know, political convention, I wasn't sure if I was going to meet a lot of, you know, fringy, angry people, but everybody is just so nice and normal, you know.
That's great. What's going on there? What are the politics? What's the buzz?
Oh, my gosh. Well, there are so many politicians coming that it's really surprising. Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer. Howard Dean was here last night. He gave a really electrifying speech. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, Bill Richardson, and Chris Dodd are all going to be here tomorrow.
Wow, this is a big deal. Describe the Daily Coast Convention to us for those folks who've never been to one, including myself.
Well, there are 1,500 people here, and it's. Just anyone can come. It's a bunch of bloggers, political activist-y people. There are workshops, panel discussions, forums, lectures, film screenings, a lot of authors with books to sell. There are workshops for media-type people about, you know, how to get your blog noticed, how to become a pundit for TV, and then for political people, there's, you know, how to craft your campaign ad, how to establish a local ballot initiative, how to run for office, or how to help a friend run for office. There's really a huge range of stuff going on. At any given time, there's like 10 or 15 rooms full of people doing things.
Have you attended any that you think are noteworthy? And if so, have you learned anything you'd like to share with our listeners, Lauren?
I had a lot of fun going to the Tri-State Caucus, the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut caucus. There are, you know, local groups of bloggers who group together to talk about local stuff, and I had a lot of fun there. It was actually kind of exciting because, you know, when you're involved in the radio, you forget what a wide audience you have. And I just said, you know, hi, I'm Lauren. I don't have a blog, but I work at Air America. And I got a round of applause.
That's great.
It was really exciting.
That's great. And so it sounds like a marvelous time is being had by all, and a lot is being learned and a lot is being taught. And it's going to be a fine event.
Yeah, people are making great connections and friends.
Yeah, great. Well, Lauren, thank you very much for checking in with us and reporting and keep track of what's going on in those events there. And if you take some notes and come back and share them with us.
I will. I'll tell you all about it when I come back.
Great. Okay. I'll see you on Monday back in New York City.
Okay. Bye, Tom.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. Good talking with you. 1-866-303-2270 and Kirk in Worcester, Mass. We have just a few seconds here before we got to take a break, Kirk.
Yeah. Tom, I wanted to ask Bernie Sanders about the 1487 Senate Resolution Ballot Integrity Act. This bill looks like it's going to make voting worse.
You're talking about Dianne Feinstein's bill?
Yes.
I agree it's going to make voting worse. It enshrines the legality of voting machines. And any, frankly, in my opinion, any bill that says that it is legal for us to privatize, corporatize our vote is wrong.
Why is Bernie co-sponsoring this bill? I mean, this bill.
Yeah, it's a good question, and we'll have to ask him the next time he's on the air. I can't speak for Bernie, I know that from the very beginning Bernie has been in favor of paper ballots, and he's been very concerned about the integrity of our vote. So, but we'll find out. 57 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Anything goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls throughout the next couple of hours here on the Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. The government of Pakistan pushing back on Barack Obama. This is fascinating. The government of Pakistan's top Pakistani officials criticizing Barack Obama. The foreign minister of Pakistan, presumably speaking on behalf of General Pervez Musharraf, the dictator in general, the foreign minister Khurshid Kasturi, said, it's a very irresponsible statement. That's all I can say is the election campaign in America is heating up. We would not like American candidates to fight their elections and contest elections at our expense. Now, the comment that Mr. Obama made a couple of days ago.
There are terrorists holed up in those mountains who murdered 3,000 Americans. They are plotting to strike again. If we have actionable intelligence about high-value terrorist targets, and President Musharraf will not act, we will.
And there's a lot of us who are wondering about this kind of testosterone match that seems to be going on in the Democratic presidential primary. And I think that just to put this stuff in context, we should hear from a Democrat and a Republican. In fact, let's reverse the order. Let's make it a Republican and a Democrat. On similar topics of war and peace. This is from 1984. Senator John Glenn, a Marine, a combat veteran, a pilot, and an astronaut running for president of the United States. This is his campaign commercial.
My real question is...
And by the way, his campaign commercial is shot as if it's a Q&A in a restaurant.
My real question is, as a military person, are you likely to get us into more combat, into more wars, tell me what we can expect from your background and how you will handle those kinds of things.
Now, I'll tell you this. I think as a military person, I am less likely, and let me tell you why. I have a military background, as I said, 23 years in the Marine Corps. I've been there. I've been shot at myself. My plane was hit on 12 different occasions. I know the terrors of war firsthand. I know what it's like to come back from a mission and sit down and have to write a next of kin letter to people I knew in the States. Friends, your husband isn't coming home. Your father is not coming home. I know what that's like. And that sears your soul. I can tell you that. I don't want to see combat ever visited again on anybody if we can possibly prevent it. And nobody is going to negotiate any harder for peace than I will.
John Glenn for president. Leadership for the future.
That a 1984 ad for John Glenn. And now let's listen to a Democrat from the past, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as president of the United States in 1938.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
So, my thoughts on that, and we had a caller calling into our comment line. And this, well, here it speaks for itself.
So Obama is now saying that as president he would bomb, Pakistan, but only if the intelligence service tells him that they have it coming. I wonder, is that the same intelligence service that guaranteed to the world that there were WMDs in Iraq? The same bunch of people?
Anyhow, it's raising some questions and raising some eyebrows, and I'll just leave it at that. I'm not certainly at all opposed to Senator Obama's candidacy or presidency. I think he'd make a great president, and I'd vote for him in a heartbeat, and I'd work for him if he's the nominee. And I really think that Democrats and the Democratic Party, not speaking specifically of what Mr. Obama said, Senator Obama said, but just broadly, that if they try to get into this testosterone-driven one-upsmanship that is circulating in the Republican Party, particularly among the chicken hawks in the Republican Party, because you don't hear much of it from the actual war veterans, John McCain excluded, he apparently has lapsed into temporary insanity over the last couple of years, but if the Democrats start getting into this same realm, I think that they do so at their own peril. Jay in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to go back to your discussions on taxes, and specifically, I was kind of astounded yesterday in reading all the discussions on the tragedy in Minnesota. Then I come upon this article from Forbes about how to live tax-free, and it quotes one person who moved to get away from taxes as saying, whenever taxes can be avoided, I feel better. And I'm thinking, somehow, some way, we've got to work on reversing this insanity that's taken hold of the country. And I mean, people, you know, no one has ever really liked taxes per se, but it's just gotten so aggressive, as you say, since the Reagan presidency, that people view taxes as sort of almost the ultimate evil in society and are forgetting about how necessary they are to pay for everything that makes a society. And if you'll indulge me for just a second, I wanted to go back. In San Diego, you may remember back in all over Southern California, in 2003, in October, we had some terrible, terrible fires. And as a matter of fact, many people lost their lives in those fires. In San Diego, there was a brief proposal after those fires to raise taxes to better fund some of the deficiencies that were revealed in our firefighting system, especially in the rural firefighting. That was pulled within 2 weeks of being proposed because it was felt that the voters would simply not support a tax increase. To me, that's the ultimate in insanity. The LA Times back in May had an article saying that, you know, several years on, many of these fire agencies in Southern California are still underfunded and are still critically deficient. Yes, that's just one example across the country of all this, but, you know, that's the problem. If you don't pay for it, it doesn't happen. And somehow, some way, the public has got to get their mind right that we really do have to pay for this. You know, what kind of society do you want? And so here's how we pay for it.
Yeah, well said, Jay. Taxes are the price of admission to a civil society. And we need to be pointing out that we built infrastructure for 40 years, and now for the last 26 years, ever since Reagan, we've been watching infrastructure deteriorate. And if we're going to get back to building it, we're going to have to roll back not just the Bush tax cuts, we're going to have to roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Absolutely right.
Absolutely nobody is willing to say that, but it's a solid truth. You can take it to the bank. Jay, thank you very much. There's a new book out called The Trap that briefly touches on this topic specifically and largely on the larger picture and does a very, very good job of it. I commend it to you. Ed in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. Great show as always. You know, you had a guy on yesterday from Heartland magazine talking about privatization and so on, too, and he couldn't understand your point about how if you let private companies come in and take over things, there's a perverse incentive for them to discredit other organizations and groups, and I thought you were right on the mark on that.
Yeah, the point being that if we privatize our roads and highways, then you will then have for-profit corporations that will start lobbying Congress to not have public transportation. When you privatize the prisons, you have private for-profit corporations lobbying Congress to pass more laws that will put more people in jail, regardless of whether they should be in jail.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely told people what you said about that. It makes so much sense. It's kind of like ripping up the tracks in Los Angeles area. And, Tom, when you do your book, Tom Speaks Out, that could be one of your chapters in there.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Ed. I appreciate it. Robert in San Francisco, California, listening on The Quake. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just fine. What's up?
Great. You know, I wanted to ask Bernie in particular, but I'll just say Kucinich has been talking about having some kind of an investigation into 9/11, or actually committed to review it again in September. And I just wanted to draw people's attention to the fact that there was bioterror training exercises at the World Trade Complex on 9/11. There are U.S. Air Force training exercises involving live-fly hijackings of commercial airliners, planes crashing into buildings. And all this stuff.
And in London, in the Tube, they were doing terrorism exercises about the Tube being blown up on July 7th, and on the day that the Tube blew up. I mean, it's downright spooky. Unless they're doing these exercises 365 days out of the year, which is pretty unlikely. But yeah, Robert, we need a new investigation of 9/11. We really do. There are too many unanswered questions, way too many. And we will be discussing that in more depth on this program too as time goes on. 1-866-303-2270, our number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room or our message board, if you want to participate in our blog, go over to airamerica.com and click Tom Hartman. Drop in and say hi. We'll be right back.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
So Patricia sends me a note, says John Glenn was a Democrat. Oops. Okay, so we heard from two Democrats, but it's the Democratic primary. Thank you for keeping me honest here. Somehow I had forgotten that. 1-866-303-2270, Cora in Bergensfield, New Jersey. Hey, Cora.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine.
Listen, I was kind of surprised when you mentioned that you'd vote for Obama right off the top.
Let me put that in context, Cora. I will vote for any Democrat over any Republican in the election of 2008, period.
Okay, I can see that. But when you have someone already talking about going to war with Pakistan, nuclear would be an option, and here we're trying to get out of Iraq, I think he's a little too eager, may I say.
Yeah, this was my concern. I'm not quite ready to condemn him for it because I want to see the larger context, and I also want to see how this shakes out over the next couple of days and what his position is. But if he's trying to position himself as the John McCain of the Democratic Party, I think we all have a problem, and I think Barack Obama's going to have a problem.
I hope more people, though, are aware of that. I mean, I'd hate to get into having a Democrat just like Bush, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I guarantee you Barack Obama is not just like Bush. But on this, in this very narrow single topic of whether or not we should go after Osama bin Laden and his merry band, I think that there's probably a broad consensus in America that we should go after bin Laden and his buddies. And I think that to a certain extent, that's what is holding that up is the fact that most Americans don't have any idea what Waziristan is like, what that region of Pakistan is like. I guarantee if Musharraf could get him, he would. You think Iraq is tough. You think Afghanistan is tough. This is a region in the world that has not been penetrated in 1,000 years successfully. I mean, even the British didn't try to go in there. So it's...
I just hope people are more aware of what's going. I mean, I just don't want to get into another issue that we have now.
None of us do, Cora. Yeah,
huh?
None of us do. None of us do. Well said. Thank you very much. Sean in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Sean.
Mir geht's, Tom.
Yeah, mir geht is gut.
Ausgezeichnet. Showing off a little of that freshman German.
Okay.
Tom, I was listening to your program earlier this morning. You had Robin Meredith on, basically making the argument for the capitalist model of globalization. Her arguments were reminding me a lot of, of course, Tom Friedman, Fareed Zakaria, and also...
Now, for people listening who are mystified, this was on the local show on AM 620 KPOJ here in Portland that precedes this national show. So our national listeners didn't hear that debate, although we recorded it and we'll probably play it sometime next week or the week after.
Okay.
But basically, she has a new book out, and it's sort of a Tom Friedman book, Isn't Globalization Wonderful? And she and I had about a 15-minute let's beat each other up session.
Exactly. But, Tom, recently I saw that movie, Thank You for Smoking. And in the movie, a tobacco lobbyist in a moment of candor says, well, I'm using the yuppie Nuremberg defense. I have to make a mortgage payment. And so my question for you is, to what extent do you think these young people coming out of our business and management schools who are spewing all this globalization stuff, how much do you think they really believe it, that we're creating a new middle class in Asia and so forth? And how much is it just very cynical, like, I'll say whatever the man wants me to say in order to, get a good job and make my mortgage payment?
Well, the fact of the matter is we are creating a new middle class in Asia, at least in Southern Asia, in India, and to some small extent in China as well. And, you could argue that that's a good thing. I'm not sure it's a good thing at the expense of the American middle class. In fact, I'm sure it's not a good thing at the expense of the American middle class, and that's the argument that I was making.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is the argument that is made by those people and those corporations that place their own corporate interests above the interests of an individual nation. And I frankly put the interests of the United States and the residents of the United States ahead of other nations. You can call me a nationalist or whatever you want in that context, but the fact of the matter is that I think that every nation does that. I think it's a human instinct.
Sure.
And in fact, I think it derives out of the instinct for family. We place our family first and our community first, our city first, our nation first, and as long as it doesn't get unhealthy, in the case of Hitler, it became profoundly unhealthy. In the case of Bush, I would argue, it has become profoundly unhealthy. But in a healthy context, I think that that's a healthy and appropriate impulse. Bill in Seattle, about a half a minute here, Bill, before we got to take a break. What's up?
Well, I think the Democrats could capitalize on the infrastructure problem by offering to divert money from the drug war to infrastructure repair. If they did this as an 08 election campaign platform plank, the Republicans would defend prohibition and lose. The Democrats.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot more than that, though. I mean, the drug war is a couple billion dollars a year. We have a $1.6 trillion infrastructure deficit in the United States.
The drug war is $60 billion tax dollars.
$60 billion a year is $60 billion is a drop in the bucket compared to $1.6 trillion. That's $1,600 billion.
Well, it's a step in the right direction, Tom. And
yeah.
I
agree. I mean, we've spent $500 billion on Iraq.
Once we get that money diverted, then it could be spent on something useful instead of wasting it on the drug war.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Bill. And we've got to go way beyond that. In my opinion, we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
George.
You may not face him here, but you'll face the man on fire.
George.
You can't do wrong and get by.
Somebody needs to tell George. And Dick, who's not a member of the executive branch or the legislative branch or the judicial branch. He's apparently created the Dick branch. Very strange. And somebody needs to tell Alberto. And it just... on and on it goes, and the weirder and weirder it gets, what's going on with all of these guys, and the testimony before the Senate, Sarah Taylor's associate over in the White House, Pat Leahy, Scott Jennings, Pat Leahy trying to get Scott Jennings to say anything coherent at all, and it was just absolutely, totally, downright strange. I don't know how to describe it beyond that. Speaking of strange.
Baby, I'm crazy.
Our crazy alert today. Well, here we have a twofer. The first story from Faceton, Vermont. Man caught in a dairy barn just before midnight was not only violating the boundaries of the farmer's property, but he admitted to police that he was there having sex with the cows. Yeah. He paid a $601 fine for his crimes. And then the other story that kind of goes back to back, no pun intended, with the same story, from Serbia. A Serbian farmer has been allowed to take his prized bull to prison with him after an emotional appeal to jail bosses. Hamdija Zurek was sentenced to a year in prison for assault after he hit another man during an argument at a local bar. Judges ruled he could take his 1.5-ton bull, Miko, with him to jail. After lawyers argued that if the farmer went to jail, the bull would have to be slaughtered because there's no one else to look after the bull. Miko will be kept in a specially converted cell on the ground floor of the prison. If both are well-behaved, they should be free by Christmas. Yeah. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number, Tom in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today? Tom? No, Tom. Okay, let's go to Weldon in British Columbia. Hey, Weldon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make everybody that listens aware that the debt ceiling limit is being reached by... just recently at $8.9 trillion. And a lot of the arguments that I get from conservatives is that, you get most of the money that is owed in the national debt is owned from one governmental agency to another. And they say that, it doesn't have to be paid back.
It's not most of it, actually, but it's much of it. You've got chunk of the Social Security deficit, for example.
I just wanted to get your sort of take on that.
My take on it is that it's a disaster. It's just an absolute disaster.
Well, that's a good one.
the largest part of it, Weldon, is it started with Ronald Reagan, and thank you for the call. So, back in 1982, it was obvious to the demographers at the Social Security Administration. This is a really important point to make, by the way. It deserves a minute or two. They saw that the boomer generation, this bulge, this population, this post-World War II population bulge was coming down the road in terms of retirement starting around 2010, 2020, and was going to wrap itself up probably around 2040, 2045 as the boomers started aggressively dying off. And looking at these numbers, Up until that point in time, up until 82, Social Security had been an entirely a pay-as-you-go program. The current workers, through their payroll deductions, were paying for the both two things. Two-thirds of the Social Security fund goes to fund the retirement of seniors, and one-third of the Social Security Trust Fund goes to pay for disabled people, and literally widows, orphans, and the disabled in the United States. And so that two-thirds that represents essentially the retired folks, that portion was going to explode. It was going to expand. And so there was this commission with Alan Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan on it, the two leaders of it, representing essentially the Republicans and the Democrats. And they spent about a year working on this thing, and they came back and they said, here's what we need to do. We need to have one generation and one generation only. And this is a really important point, and the vast majority of Americans, I'll bet you 99% of Americans don't know this. They came back and they said, we're going to have one generation of Americans, the baby boomers, not only pay for the retirement of their parents, like all generations prior to 1982 have been doing. And keep in mind, in 1980, people working in 1980 and paying into Social Security were paying for people already retired. And every year, Social Security would say, okay, we spent $600 billion this year. The tax needs to be at $600 billion. So Social Security was always at zero at the end of the year. Slight surplus, but, you know, typically the goal was to have it at zero, and because it was a pay-as-you-go program. And they said, so what we're going to do is we're going to continue that. So the baby boomers are going to pay for the retirement of their parents. The Social Security money that my mother is getting right now and that my dad got before he died last year is paid for by me and you, right, all of us. Not only are the baby boomers going to pay for the retirement of their parents, but they're also going to pay into a savings account for their own retirement. Never happened before with Social Security. And once the last of the baby boomers dies, we'll go back to a pay-as-you-go system, and the generation after the baby boomers will not pay for their own retirement by paying into a savings account. Instead, they'll go back to simply paying for the retirement of the generation before them. It'll actually be, you know, by that point, it'll be three generations down the road, because every 20 years is a new generation in demographer terms. 19 years, according to Thomas Jefferson, but typically people figure 20 years. So in 82, Reagan signed into law the largest tax increase in the history of the United States, doubling the Social Security tax, and a tax, by the way, that at that time was only paid by people earning less than $40,000 a year. So the millionaires and billionaires and even the upper middle class did not experience a tax increase on anything above the 30-some-odd, the high 30s, low $40,000. Now it's around $90,000 because it's been indexed to inflation. So still, millionaires and billionaires do not pay into this after that first $90,000. They don't pay a penny in taxes on it after the first $90,000 of taxable income. So this then created this savings account, the Social Security Trust Fund, which had never existed before. And it was the baby boomers paying into a savings account for their own retirement. That savings account was supposed to accumulate during the 1980s and the 1990s and the first decade of 2000. And it would save up trillions and trillions of dollars. And then that money would be paid out, and it would gain interest during that time as well. And that money then would be paid out to the baby boomers who paid into it as they retired. And then once the Social Security Trust Fund was designed to self-destruct. It was designed that by 2045 or 2050 at the most, it would simply go away, and Social Security, because the boomers would have taken back out all the money that they paid in, and Social Security would go back to, and the taxes would go back down, and Social Security would go back to a program where the current generation is simply paying for the retirement of the people who retired before them. And then Reagan did his tax cuts. He dropped the top tax rate from 70%, which is where Jack Kennedy set it. And Kennedy had actually increased taxes. The top tax rate had been 91% before that. And you will hear Republicans all the time saying, well, you know, Jack Kennedy lowered taxes. Not quite true. And Kennedy was pretty explicit about this, that he was not proposing to lower taxes, that he was proposing instead to raise taxes in a way that that would, by closing up loopholes, he was essentially proposing to raise taxes. In fact, here's Jack Kennedy talking about this in the debates with Richard Nixon.
So in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education, we'd spend more money on housing, we'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense in this administration.
Let me just back this up a little bit here to the beginning.
Yes, I have stated in both the debates and state again that I believe in a balanced budget and have supported that concept during my 14 years in the Congress. The only two times when an unbalanced budget is warranted would be during a serious recession, and we had that in 58 in an unbalanced budget of $12 billion, or a national emergency where there should be large expenditures for national defense, which we had in World War II and during part of the Korean War.
So that's it, in the current situation.
Third, I think it's possible to gain a $700 million to $1 billion through tax changes, which I believe would close up loopholes on dividend withholding, on expense accounts.
Notice he said gain. He dropped the tax rate from 91% to 70%, but he made the point. He's one of those guys in that tax bracket. Nobody's paying that. And so then he says,
so in my judgment, we would spend more money in this administration on aid to education. We'd spend more money on housing. We'd spend more money, and I hope more wisely, on defense than this administration has done. But I believe that the next administration should work for a balanced budget, and that would be my intention. Mr. Nixon misstates my figures constantly, which is, of course, his right. But the fact of the matter is, here is where I stand, and I just want to have it on the public record.
So there it is on the public record. Jack Kennedy actually raised the income tax during his administration when he cut the top rate from 91 to 70%. And so now we have a situation where Social Security is going to have to be paid back out of the income tax. It's a total mess. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Not a good idea. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Just to wrap up that riff from the last segment. In 81, Reagan dropped taxes right through the floor, income taxes. Dropped them right through the floor. In 82, they reformed, as I recall, they reformed, in quotes, Social Security so that one generation would not only pay for its parents' retirement, but also pay for its own retirement by putting money into a savings account. By 83, it became obvious to Reagan, or at least to people within Reagan's administration, I'm not sure anything was ever obvious to Reagan, it became obvious that Reagan's tax cuts were bankrupting the United States. Reagan ran up a greater debt in his 8 years as president than all the other presidents from George Washington to Ronald Reagan combined. Every war we ever fought, every debt we ever had, add them all together, and it was not as many dollars as Ronald Reagan ran up in debt. So he was bankrupting this country with his crazy tax cut. The Reagan tax cut that I'm saying needs to be rolled back. And so he went to Alan Greenspan and he said, what do I do? And Greenspan said, well, if you borrow from Social Security, it'll be the government loaning money to the government and won't show up in your deficit numbers. And that's what Reagan did. And has been done by every president since him. And so now Social Security has been tapped out, the trust fund, the savings account that the boomers paid into. And in order to pay that money back, there's going to have to be a serious reckoning because the only way to raise that money now, because it's got to come out of the general fund and go back to the Social Security Trust Fund, is to raise income taxes. We've got a lot of sins of the Reagan administration that we all have to collectively pay for, tragically. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, thanks very much for taking my call. Yeah, you had a caller earlier who was criticizing Senator Obama with respect to his comments about Pakistan, but I feel like I have to defend Senator Obama. Even though my greater preference is for John Edwards, I think he would be a strong candidate. But still, nonetheless, I think, you know, when Senator Obama is advocating with respect to Pakistan is no different than what we did with respect to Afghanistan in 2001, when it was harboring and giving safe haven to bin Laden, our worst terrorist enemy. We went after him in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and you're right, Jerry, but keep in mind, Afghanistan offered to give up bin Laden. And we said, no, thank you. We're not going to take him from you. We're instead going to bomb you. And I think that was a huge mistake. There is no country that has ever successfully colonized Afghanistan. The Russians tried. The British tried. It absolutely failed.
And
it's not going to succeed in Pakistan either.
No, well, it was a little bit more complicated than that because there were certain conditions that the Bush administration wanted that the Afghan Taliban government was not ready to meet. But with respect to Pakistan's dictator, Musharraf, he has made a Neville Chamberlain type of appeasement deal with Al-Qaeda. And, you know, they say that this, that where Al-Qaeda is supposed to be this tribal, supposed to be this nowheres, this no man's. It's supposed to be like an area that no one can control. And I don't see anything wrong with saying, well, if Musharraf, if he cannot control the area, then we'll go in and, we'll do something.
Yeah,
to
see a lot wrong with the jury. Here's my concern is that if we try to, sorry, we got an echo here, but your point was made, and made well. If we go in there, just us, it's going to be one more America against the Muslim world. That's how it's going to be perceived. The way to take bin Laden out of Waziristan is to pull together the Muslim countries in that area, in that region. All of them. Iran, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon. Lebanon, arguably not entirely a Muslim country. All of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Poland, Iraq. Pull them all together and you know, through the Arab League or something, somehow put together a multilateral force that does not involve the United States. That is Muslim militias and Muslim military saying to Pakistan, we'll help you take out the lawless guy. And do it on the ground and do it right so that you minimize civilian casualties. But for the United States to go into a tribal region of Pakistan, which is not lightly populated, by the way, there are a lot of people living there, and just start dropping bombs on people's heads is going to, in my opinion, bring us to the same kind of hell that we are now facing in Afghanistan that is massively underreported, and the same kind of hell that we are facing in Iraq. Nobody has ever been able, no European power, no non-Muslim power has ever been able to successfully occupy one of these Middle Eastern Muslim lands for very long, and every country that has tried has paid a horrible price. And for us to try it in Pakistan, in my opinion, is just as stupid as us trying to do it in Afghanistan. And, you know, I guess I'll be on the record as saying that. Anyhow, John in North Hollywood, California. Hey, John.
Hi. I don't think that we should attempt, at this time at least, to go after Osama bin Laden, because I think it would be just jumping the gun like we've been doing ever since, Afghanistan. One of the keys to fighting an enemy is keeping your head and not losing it and controlling your fear, which is courage, by the way, not ignoring it. We need to do that as a country, and by going after Osama, who basically represents fear, it basically just keeps us reacting to our emotions. We need to find out the truth about who all of our enemy is, not just Osama. And one of the things, one of the ways maybe looking more at 911, if he worked alone or in complicity with someone, either foreign or domestic, and we need to take our time and not jump the gun.
Yeah, good point, John, and well said. Here's where I would take that, and that is to say, we need to turn. And I think we were at the edge of it. We could have done it. We need to turn bin Laden and his whole philosophy, his whole worldview, into a pariah. so that the entire world is horrified, as they were in the weeks after 9/11. And they, the rest of the world will unite to say, okay, we'll take care of this guy. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Wild stuff happening in Washington, D.C. George Bush saying that Congress, if it doesn't give him the right to spy some more, he's going to use his constitutional authority to keep Congress in session, to not let them go home on vacation. He says, we've worked hard and in good faith with the Democrats to find a solution, but we are not going to put our national security at risk. Time is short. He's trying to use this recess as a lever to get the Democrats to do what they did with the Patriot Act, jam a piece of legislation through at the last minute without much thought and without much debate and without hearing from the American people on it, and it's wrong. And you might want to consider taking a minute and calling your member of the, particularly the Senate. You have two senators, unless you live in Washington, D.C. Each one of us has two senators. And your member of the House of Representatives. 202-225-3121 is the number for the Capitol switchboard. And you simply say, hey, I live in whatever state. I live in Michigan. I'm not sure who my senators are. Who are they? And they'll say, oh, it's a Stabenow and what's his name? Carl Levin. And say, okay, put me through to one of them. Or I live in, you know, and just, if you're not sure, just tell them where you live. If you're not sure who represents you in the House of Representatives, just give me your zip code. It's time to push back on this. What I want to know is, when Bush was illegally spying, is the reason why he's absolutely refusing to turn any of this information over to Congress? And perhaps the reason why this federal judge, now here we've got John Boehner, who has apparently declassified information, and said that a federal judge has actually ruled against parts of Bush's illegal program, and therefore we should legalize it. Say, what? It's unconstitutional, therefore we should do it! So he's out there pushing in the House of Representatives saying, well, you know, and Bush is saying, but here's the question in my mind. When Bush was doing his illegal spy, and it apparently still is, but at the height of it, was he spying on Democrats specifically? Was he spying on the Democratic leadership? Was he spying on the anti-war movement? Was he listening to my phone calls? Was he listening to your phone calls? Was he reading your email? Was he reading your congressman's or congresswoman's email? We know, they have admitted it, that a member of Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, the senator from Utah, that a member of his staff had hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer, Ted Kennedy on the Judiciary Committee, and several other members of the Judiciary Committee, and for a year and a half was reading all of their correspondence about how they were going to deal with the Senate nominations, or the appointments to the Supreme Court, of the appointment to the Supreme Court of Sam Alito. That they had hacked into these guys' computers, and they were and other federal judges as well, and were keeping track. So the Republicans were always three steps ahead of the Democrats. Democrats couldn't figure out it why, and it was because a member of Orrin Hatch's staff had hacked into their computers. This is a fact. I mean, this is on the public record. Hatch has apologized and fired the guy. So we know Republicans will spy on Democrats given half a chance. Is that what the whole thing was about? And so anyway, that's what's going on right now. And we'll see how the Democrats respond to this. It's going to be very interesting the next few hours, how this plays out. And it's been a long time since we've had two crazy alerts in one day, but we got another one here. This is a genuine crazy alert, I'm telling you. This guy's really crazy. And, in fact, he's been a guest on this program several times, and I'm just startled, because I always thought Tom Tancredo, while I strongly disagree with his politics and his positions on many things, including most of his positions on immigration, I always thought he was a rational guy. He has now come out and proposed on Tuesday. This is incredible. On Tuesday, he was speaking before a group as part of his presidential campaign, apparently, proposed that we tell the Muslim world, like there's some cohesive thing out there, that if there are any terrorist attacks against the United States, we will bomb Mecca and Medina, the two holiest sites in Islam that happen to be located in Saudi Arabia. Can you imagine if the Protestant, largely Protestant government of the United Kingdom, Great Britain, in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, when the IRA was regularly blowing things up in the United Kingdom, the Irish Republican Army, the Catholic Irish Republican Army, if when the IRA was blowing things up, and in fact even tried to kill Margaret Thatcher, blew up a bomb at number 10 Downing Street, tried to kill the Prime Minister. I mean, we haven't had anything like a bomb going off at the White House here. This was in the United Kingdom. This was, and thank God we haven't, and hopefully we won't. But this was, can you imagine if the Protestant guy, if Maggie Thatcher, after that bomb went off at number 10 Downing Street, had come out and said, okay, if any Catholics out there blow off another bomb in the United Kingdom, we're going to bomb the Vatican. Because bombing holy sites will stop Catholics from bombing us. What do you think would have happened? This is what Tom Tancredo said. He said, if it's up to me, we are going to explain that an attack on this homeland of that nature would be followed by an attack on the holy sites of Mecca and Medina. This is the only thing I can think of that would deter somebody from doing what they would otherwise do. Well, Tom Tancredo, if that's the only thing you can think of, you need to change meds. This is scary. And then Babe Buchanan, Pat Buchanan's brother and a senior Tancredo advisor, she says, this shows we mean business. There's no more effective deterrent than that. Yeah, right. That's why Maggie Thatcher did it. That's why she told the Irish Republican Army that if they bombed the United Kingdom, that she was going to bomb the Vatican. And it went over very well with the Vatican. Come on. These people really and truly are crazy. Michael in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Last week I noticed quite a number of billboards, dozens of billboards in Tacoma, red, white, and blue, that said constitutions matter. So I thought, gee, whoa, somebody like George Soros must be funding some impeachment effort. A closer look revealed that they were all billboards owned by Clear Channel. And I thought, gee, Clear Channel, aren't they kind of conservative? Why would they be doing that? It can't be just for the money.
Well, actually, I'm sure that they were doing it for the money. Clear Channel doesn't put up things on their billboards unless they're paid for. They basically just own the advertising space.
Right.
So
somebody
bought those ads.
But, okay, so that's what I thought. But then in the Tacoma News Tribune on Tuesday, there was a story that what in fact had happened was there was a moratorium on large billboards put in place 10 years ago, and Clear Channel had to remove billboards larger than a certain size starting August 1st, which was Wednesday. Apparently, Clear Channel put up those billboards on their own as a way to object to the city of Tacoma impinging on their First Amendment rights of free speech.
Oh, that's interesting. Or some perhaps right in the Washington State Constitution.
No,
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
So here I thought we were getting great publicity for the fact that George Bush is destroying the Constitution.
Take it. Tell all your friends that constitutions matter. I mean, it's like when I lived in Vermont and Howard Dean was the governor and the state Supreme Court said that we had to pass either gay marriages or civil unions. The legislature got together, passed a civil unions law, and Howard Dean was going to sign it. And there were all these hysterical and frantic right-wingers all over the state who were painting the sides of their barns and putting out signs in their front yards that said, take back Vermont. And, of course, what they meant was for the right-wingers, the conservatives, to take Vermont back from those nasty liberals and not allow those homosexuals to get married, right, or to have civil unions. Well, in fact, what happened was all kinds of tourists came to Vermont that summer, and they saw all these signs, and they thought that it meant buy some maple syrup and take it home with you. Take some of Vermont home. And, you know, it helped the maple syrup industry. So point out the billboards and just, you know, claim credit for them. 16 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday. Any topic you want to call about, we'll pick it up. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic if you're doing that.
Thank you.
You get any sleep?
Yes, Mr. President, how about taking care of the working man and woman in the United States for a change? 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Anthony in Anaheim, California. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom, you there?
Yes, I am, and you're on the air.
Hey, let me start off by saying what a pleasure and an honor it is to speak with you. I regard your opinion very highly. I just wanted to speak about the presidential candidates, and you know we got the new rhetoric by Barack Obama, and we know the heir of Hillary is the heiress to NAFTA, and I just believe that the Democratic candidates are they're making me very disillusioned, and I believe the only person who has anything credible to talk about and wants to instill the Constitution back into our society is Ron Paul, and I want to know your thoughts on him.
Well, Ron Paul is a libertarian, as you probably know. He ran for president as a libertarian about 6 years ago or 8 years ago, whenever it was, sometime the two election cycles ago, as I recall, and believes that we should do away with Social Security, that we should privatize our roads, that we should not have any national health care system, that we should do away with Medicaid, we should do away with Medicare, we should do away with public education. Everybody should pay for their own education. And if you're not rich enough to be able to educate your children, tough, they don't go to school. I mean, that's his worldview and that's his perspective. I disagree with it. I respect his respect for the Constitution, but I disagree with his interpretation of it. I think when
do
the
you
Constitution...
think, do you think that those types of idealistic, situations are possible to enact, even if he were to take, how could he take over the public school system and tell everybody they have to pay for it?
Well, they're about halfway there right now, Anthony, and the way that they're doing it is by destroying public education. No Child Left Behind Act, for example, is a part of it. It's the Katrina strategy. What you do is you destroy a public institution, and then you say, hey, look at it, it's broken. So they're destroying our public schools. They're not funding them. They haven't been building the physical infrastructure. They're not keeping up with the costs. They want to pay teachers less and less. There's a constant attack, constant assault on teachers in the United States, largely because they're unionized. And in fact, here in Oregon, we've got, you know, a right-wing group that is going to be putting on the ballot this year a ballot initiative that says that teachers' pay will be a function of how well the kids do in their classroom. Well, that's going to be fine for white upper-middle-class neighborhoods, or actually any kind of upper-middle-class neighborhood, but it's not going to be fine for inner-city communities. It's not going to be fine for poor neighborhoods where you've got both parents having to work, you know, a full-time job, and they can't afford to pay for private tuition and tutors for their kids, and they're not there to make sure that their kids are doing their homework. And the kids are not doing all that well. And what's going to happen is that the public education part of public education is going to get whacked. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to destroy these things through the back door. And Ron Paul salutes that. He wants to see vouchers for our schools. So, no, I disagree with you. I don't think Ron Paul's the guy. Although, you know, as I said, I respect his idealism. I just think it's wrongheaded. I think he's going down the wrong road. He's been on this program a couple of times. We've talked with him a number of times. And I've told him that straight up. In my opinion, you've got Dennis Kucinich and you've got John Edwards, the two guys who are speaking straight, in my opinion, in the Democratic side. At least, I don't want to say the two guys who are speaking straight. I think that they're all speaking their own truths. The two guys who most coincide with my worldview. And you know, each of us needs to think for ourselves and you know, look at our own perspectives. Anyhow, Carolyn, Tempe, Arizona.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm glad to hear you've calmed down. You were starting to sound like one of those angry, fringy people. And I was calling in because I would like to address the young woman who called in and characterized the folks at Daily Coast, who do a great job, in my opinion, as nice and normal as opposed to angry and fringy. And my question to her would be, who are these angry, fringy people? And I would suggest that under the anger is fear, brought on by an awareness of exactly what the Bush administration is doing. And if you're not angry about what the Bush administration has done and is doing, you're either not informed or you're a neocon. Now, the only people I've heard referring to the Democratic base is angry and fringy are the DLC Democrats, the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, who are trying to denigrate.
Yeah, I think Lauren's point was that she was trying to put the lie to that meme that is out there, both on the Fox News channel and on her faux news and on the left to a certain extent among the DLC guys. No, you're absolutely right. And I think that there's a distinction to be made between righteous anger, which I think that many of us, all of us probably are feeling, and out of control, irrational anger. And certainly the Republicans and the cons would like to portray the rational, righteous anger that many Americans are feeling of both parties about the violations of the Constitution and the trashing of the Constitution, and frankly, the trashing of this country that's being done by the Republicans and the Bush administration. And
the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Anything goes. She. Oh, yeah. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And we're taking your calls on pretty much any topic you want today. Lewis in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Lewis, what's up? Lewis?
Oh, yes.
You're on the air.
Okay, here's what I want to talk about.
Did you know that Nixon had a special bombing operation called Operation Menu, where he actually bombed hospitals, and some of them had a Red Cross on top of the roofs of these hospitals in North Vietnam in 1969?
I know that he was you know, intentionally bombing North Vietnam and civilian areas in North Vietnam. He thought it would demoralize the North Vietnamese. I didn't know specifically that he had specifically targeted hospitals, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, according to the New York Times, they released all these stories, and then they started to wiretap people in Washington because they didn't like the idea that these secret bombings were revealed. And while he was being impeached, he started to bomb Laos, and then he went to Cambodia. And the Times writers were saying, should we have war crime trials? And it seems to me that since we didn't straight out Vietnam, everything that Nixon put into the machinery that we're facing today, did you ever hear his authorization for surreptitious entry? How he also tried to put all the crimes under the federal government? This man created all the machinery that's being used today.
Much of it was dismantled at the time. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, for example, of 1978, was in direct response to Nixon and Nixon's illegal spying on people. And they said, no, we're not going to allow that to happen anymore. And so now Bush comes along and he illegally spies on people. And as I said, I think he's spying on Democrats specifically. I think that Karl Rove is spying on people using these laws. And I think that that's the reason why Bush will not allow any of these guys to testify before Congress. And he's bringing back what Nixon did.
Yeah,
it's the reincarnation of Nixon. Only worse. Worse.
And I'm saying, since we had no war crime trials, the way the New York Times advocated, some of the reporters advocated, that there were war crimes here, and since there's no consequences for war crimes.
No, Lewis, I get it, and I agree with you. And in fact, it goes beyond that. This is why Nixon should have been impeached. And it's why Gerry Ford pardoning Nixon was wrong. Ford should not have pardoned Nixon. There should have been criminal prosecutions that went ahead because Nixon had committed crimes. And what Ford did is he established a terrible precedent that George W. Bush is relying on. Gene in Los Angeles. Hey, Gene.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask you what you think of this campaign spending that we have going on. I mean, last election, Bush spent $300 million to get elected, and now we have the spending escalating even higher, and I want to know what you think the solution is to that, and if you'd allow me to respond to your answer.
Sure. I think the solution is public financing of campaigns, the way that they're doing it in Arizona and Maine and the way that we do it here in Portland, Oregon.
Okay, well, I thought that was going to be your response, and I've worked in the voluntary public financing movement for a long time, and I got out of it because I got disillusioned with it. I don't think that works, really. It's voluntary, right?
What's your alternative? Well, yeah, it is and it isn't. Here, the way it works in Portland is that if you get 1,000 signatures and $5 from each person.
Oh, I know how it works. If you want to tell your audience, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. If you get 1,000 signatures and $5 from each person, or $5,000, then you qualify, and the city gives you $100,000. Now, in addition to that, and this happened in the last election, we had a guy named Eric Sten who was running for city council. In fact, he's already on the city council. In fact, this whole public financing thing was in large part his idea. He's a great guy. And here he is running for reelection. And Jenny Burdick was put up against him. She was formerly a progressive member of the legislature, fairly progressive member, Democratic member of the legislature. But she was working for a PR firm that had among its clients Enron. And or the power company now that was spun off of Enron. And so she's running against him. And there's a widespread suspicion that she's, shall we say, not favorable toward public power at the very least. And she's getting money, and she gets an additional $10,000-$20,000, I forget the exact amount, over that $100,000. So at that point, the city goes to Eric Sten and says, okay, here's another $20,000 to match, what Ginny has made. So for every dollar that she spends, he gets matching dollars. If she spent $1 million, he would have gotten $900,000. And what it does is two things. Number one, it keeps the people in the system constantly up to whatever the highest threshold is, which our federal program doesn't do, and it's the big deficiency of it.
Well, you're aware that
And number two, well, let me just finish this point. And number two, what it does is every time those matching funds are distributed, everybody, all the voters suddenly say, oh, look at that other candidate just raised another, you know, $25,000 from the corporation. And so we're going to have to match that with our tax dollars. And people, I don't think, are very pleased about that, frankly.
Okay, but Tom, do you understand that's a total capitulation to the Supreme Court? You have three options. You can do campaign spending limits. You can do mandatory public financing, or you can do voluntary public financing. Voluntary, you have the campaigns that opt out. They can spend whatever they want, as much as they want, and the matching funds only goes up to a certain amount.
Not
but
necessarily.
Really,
the matching funds
limits,
can be configured
spending
to be...
limits is so much easier for people to understand. And
I agree with you, and that's the way it's done in the United Kingdom. You can't
spend
more than 100,000 pounds on a race for the House of Commons. The problem is that in the United States, the Supreme Court has ruled that campaign spending limits like that are a restriction on free speech, that political speech is...
That's why I say it's a total capitulation. They've also said...
Well, you don't have any choice but to capitulate to the Supreme Court.
I'm sorry?
You don't have any choice but to capitulate to the Supreme Court. It's the top court in the land.
But to bill it as a true answer and not admit that it's only a capitulation and only about half as effective as the other two alternatives is not right either.
But the other alternatives are not viable. You can't do them. They're not legal. Or at least the campaign spending limits, it doesn't work. As long as we have a constitution and laws and a bill of rights,
there are campaign
that
spending
says,
limits in plenty of countries, Tom. The only problem is the governments there don't enforce them.
You have campaign spending limits in countries that don't have our constitution, Gene. Our constitution says that political speech is the most protected form of speech.
It's that they've used the First Amendment, freedom of speech, which they don't have in other countries. They've used that to hit the campaign finance, the campaign spending limits movement over the head with.
And on that point, Gene, you and I absolutely agree. And I do not agree with the Supreme Court in their, the two major findings in this last century about this, that money equals speech. I disagree with them on that. But the fact of the matter is that that's how they ruled. And because that's the ruling right now. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Campaign spending limits does everything that public financing does. If you reduce campaign spending enough...
I agree. You just can't do it in the United States.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. I absolutely agree. And I think it would be a marvelous thing. I think that the British system to say you cannot spend more than 100,000 pounds, about 180,000 bucks, I think, right now at the exchange rate. You can't spend more than that on a campaign. And anybody who spends any money to promote your candidacy, that's considered part of that $180,000. Nobody can spend more than that in total. That's why campaigns in the United Kingdom only last a few weeks. And I think it would be a great thing to do something like that in the United States, but we can't, unfortunately, unless you change the composition of the Supreme Court. Pretty radically. So, anyhow, John in Mill Valley, California. Hey, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You made a comment earlier in the last hour regarding who you would vote for, Democrat. You'd vote for any Democrat over any Republican.
Well, I suppose there are probably some limits. If Joe Lieberman is running for anything as a Democrat, I would vote for him.
Okay. That's a good start. But I was really going to take issue with Hillary Clinton. Just in the last week, one of her old classmates acknowledged that she was a Republican in college. She's now taking money.
Well, she's proudly proclaimed that she was a Goldwater girl. I mean, she worked on the Goldwater campaign the same year that I did. Just because in 1964 people were misguided. I was 13. She was 19, I think.
Yeah.
We were both wrong. And within a year or two, both of us had seen the light. I don't have a problem with that, and that was no secret. I mean, she's always bragged about it.
Yeah.
I think if you've... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to point out that, today, if she's taking money from News Corp and Rupert Murdoch, and her husband's hanging out with the Bush family and trying to get on the Carlyle Group's board of directors or something, I think we're getting more of the same, because I think both the Clintons really are Republicans in Democratic clothing on most of their issues, and that they make great Republicans, but I don't think they make great Democrats. And
I have mentioned, in my opinion, that Bill Clinton he campaigned in 1992 as a progressive Democrat. But then a few weeks after he won the election and before he was sworn into office, as I recall, it was Bob Rubin and Alan Greenspan, sat him down and said, let us tell you the facts of life. This has been written about at some length.
Yeah.
And he governed as a conservative. In fact, he was, in my opinion, far more conservative than Dwight Eisenhower, who was actually a Republican. But, you know, that said, I'm of the opinion that Hillary Clinton is a very political animal, just as, you know, as any good politician is. And if enough of us are sufficiently active, and are sufficiently, you know, out there, that she will, I believe, that she will adopt positions that are more progressive if she gets it, that America is more progressive. Now, I may be wrong on that, but I don't think so. And that's why, you know, I would take her over any Republican. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Justin Ewan, who's running our board here yesterday and today, to Carmen Shamwell, who's answering our phones, and the two of them keeping everything together and the spaceship flying straight and level through the air here over at Air America in New York, to Ben at the White Rose Society, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives over on our website at TomHartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you very much. Over in the chat room, Fred42, you can get to our live chat room by going to TomHartman.com or AirAmerica.com. Fred42 points out, John Edwards takes on Rupert Murdoch. The time has come, says John Edwards, for Democrats to stop pretending to be friends with the very people who demonize the Democratic Party. Yeah. Cool. Media revelations, the yearly coast. Bloggers are not chaotic. They carry political clout. Yeah. People are waking up. Isn't it a fine thing? Dell in Walkerford, Maine. Hey, Dell, what's on your mind today?
Listener
Del.
Since Al Franken off the air.
Thank you, Dell.
The question about health care. I'm on the preventative side of health care. I try to prevent diseases like your father died of and my grandfather died of. There's been no discussion of and I'm all for a national payer-type system, but there's been no discussion of how this parallel system of workers' compensation would be affected. And in a way, workers' compensation does apply leverage to companies to, do the right thing and provide health and safety in the workplace.
Right. Well, what you do is you have workers' comp, instead of having workers' comp just provide health care, since everybody has health care if you have a national health care program, you have workers' comp provide disability, basically, you know, a paycheck.
Okay, I see. Do you think this will minimize the leverage that workers' comp does apply to?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, if employers still have to pay into it, and if it provides a healthy paycheck so that people can actually survive if they're injured on the job, and I don't think so.
Something else I think we should talk about is what would happen to all the workers in the current system, and how would they be provided for a transition into a national system.
Yeah, well, you would simply have health insurance available to you instantly. I mean, if we just said everybody's in Medicare right now, your Medicare taxes just went up, and everybody's in Medicare, and nobody has to pay for health insurance anymore.
I'm talking about the workers that are employed by healthcare companies. How would they be thought of in the transition?
They're going to find other jobs. Yeah, they're going to have to find other jobs. And, you know, it's not like we haven't had industries go bust before. Look at the buggy whip makers, you know, at the turn of the last century.
Oh, yeah.
They're just going to have to find other jobs.
Well, I think whatever we transition into has to be, those folks should be thought of, too.
I agree.
More people buy into this
idea. I agree. And I'll tell you, if we had a national health care system, you would have a lot of manufacturers seriously considering building here rather than building in other countries where they don't have to pay for health care. And so I think
I agree.
Yeah, it would expand the manufacturing base. Dell, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark in Houston, Texas. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. I wanted to follow up to the interview earlier in the week with Rykoff of OpTruth.
Yes.
I was really shocked. I was in my car, and I was really shocked to hear the guy kind of obfuscate about the great number of scenarios that there could be for this, what appears to be something very sinister. You know, it's just being called friendly fire. Is it not a fact that he was shot in the forehead 3 times?
Yeah, and that is causing a lot of us to think that he was murdered. And I think Paul Rykoff's point was that could be, or, you know, I said, but 3 bullets? He says, yeah, the and I didn't realize this. You know, I've fired Uzis before, but I've never fired an M1. He said that whatever they're using right now in Iraq, he said that particular rifle that they use, when it's on full auto, you pull a trigger once, you get 3 rounds off. And so,
okay,
you know,
well, that makes sense, but I was also surprised to hear him say he could have fell on his weapon.
Right, and if you drop a weapon, sometimes they will discharge. And again, if it's on full automatic and it thinks that that's a single, you know, trigger pull and that it emits 3 bullets, that's conceivable. I mean, it's extremely unlikely, but it's conceivable. I think the bottom line is that rather than immediately pointing fingers and going off and saying, I know what it was, what we need to do is have a serious, thorough, in-depth investigation. And that's what
we're going to get that, Tom.
I doubt it. I doubt it from this administration, although Congress is pushing really hard, and I hope they continue pushing, and I think that we need to be contacting our members of Congress and telling them, you know, we'd like to know what happened to Pat Tillman, by the way. Thank you very much. D in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, D, what's up? D? No D. Okay, let's go to William in Long Beach, California. Hey, William.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And one of the things that I was just thinking back on is that everybody is talking about, you know, bombing Pakistan and whatever, but nobody really wants to look back at that Marvin Bush was head of security at the World Trade Centers, as well as airport and United Airlines, and quit the day before 9/11 happened.
No, he actually quit about a year and a half before. And he wasn't in charge. He quit a year and a half before, and he had been on the board of the company. It's a huge difference.
I
may be wrong, but I don't think so. It was like a year and a half before, and he wasn't in charge of security. He was on the board of directors of the company that was responsible for security. The Bush family doesn't get in charge of anything. They don't get their hands dirty. You know, it's when you're born with a multi-million dollar trust fund, you know, anyhow, Eric in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Eric.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. We have just a half a minute here before we have to wrap up the show. What's up?
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that we have to impeach the president. I mean, pick a reason. But basically, whenever I talk to my conservative friends about it, I always say to them, the next president's going to be a Democrat. Doesn't matter who it is. It's going to be a Democrat. When I ask them, do you want the next president, a Democrat, to have all the powers?
Well, it even goes beyond that, Eric. It even goes beyond that. Do you want the next president, a Democrat, to believe that they can break the law with impunity? Forget about the power. Well, don't forget about the powers. Those are important, too. But breaking the law with impunity is a big one. In my, you know, we need to have accountability. Coming up Monday, I'll be debating Dr. Carlson on the role of women in our military. Johan Hari is here about neocons on a cruise, what conservatives say when they think we're not listening. Chris Mooney on his book Storm World, Hurricanes, Politics, and the Battle Over Global Warming. And your calls, of course. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.